All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Hello and welcome again to the Read Rothbard podcast. This is the Thanksgiving special. How are you doing, Robert? Is it too early?
Let's do this.
Is it too early to have Christmas lights up?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Me and Apple probably do that already, though.
We already did, man. And it's, Thanksgiving coming right up. We're posting this on Wednesday, so it's Thanksgiving tomorrow. And you guys know what the day after Thanksgiving is, right? Like, after you have that fight with your crazy conservative uncle and your super liberal leftist aunt, it's not only a time to get over the hangover and the turkey hangover, but it's also Black Friday, where there's deals and specials on all sorts of stuff. And Tom Woods is running a special on his premier product, the Liberty Classroom, and it's where you'll learn audio and video lectures and courses on Austrian economics, U.S. history, Western civilization logic, all those things that none of these SJWs or any of these unprincipled people know anything about, so that the next time you have to sit through a Thanksgiving dinner, you'll actually have something coherent to say to them and shut that shit down. How you doing, Robert? Oh, by the way, that's at Liberty Classroom. ReadRothbard.com/Liberty Classroom. And I ask again, Robert, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm living life, loving life. Can't live it enough.
Thanksgiving times, man. Thanksgiving times.
The time to thanks. Time to give thanks for the colonists, you know, breaking bread with the natives. And we're going to talk about Charlie Brown Thanksgiving and stuff, right?
Yeah, it seems to be like the forgotten holiday special. There's always the Charlie Brown Christmas with the, you know, sad tree with the one ball hanging on it. And then there's the Great Pumpkin, which is the Halloween one. And how Halloween gets ahead of Thanksgiving, I don't know. I think normally Thanksgiving is a bigger deal than Halloween, but not in the Charlie Brown universe.
You know, did you see that Peanuts movie, Charlie Brown Peanuts?
Like recent?
Yeah, it was like last year or the year ago.
No.
Animated.
You know I don't see movies, Robert, even though we talk about movies on the Read Rothbard podcast as a means to bridge popular culture and Austrian economics libertarianism together for the layperson. But I don't watch movies, except for Snowden I saw, because I made a special effort to do it.
Yeah, well, this is a kid's movie, and I just wanted to say that all Peanut stuff is all the same. That's all I wanted to say. You change, like, the colors, but it's the same crap. And maybe that's why it doesn't resonate with today's audience. I don't know. Anyway.
Oh, did it bomb? Did it not do well?
Oh, no, it did quite well.
Well, then you said
really well reviewed.
You said it didn't resonate.
Well, like the older stuff. But it didn't resonate with me. Like when I watched it, I was like, this is okay. But it's the same thing over and over again with Peanuts. You watch a Peanuts movie, you watch anything Peanuts, and you know what you're going to get. You're going to get Charlie Brown. You're going to get him missing the football. And you're going to get a guy that just can't win, and I don't know.
And the advice for 5 cents, and the complaints.
Yeah, I don't know. It's
yeah,
like
well,
I could write a Charlie Brown movie in like 10 minutes. Anyway, go ahead. Let's do this. Let's do this, Daniel.
Well, it's kind of like the Read Rothbard podcast, where you know what you're going to get from Robert. You're going to get, it's immoral.
Yeah.
Can't do it. Anarchy. And then you'll get a lot of what have you and whatever's from us. So much.
Let's
so rant. Yeah, and you can probably play some bingo out of that or a drinking game. Take your pick. Or maybe combine the two. I don't know.
Listen, when you have a proven winning formula, you stick with it. Just like Charlie Brown.
Right, and we are winning. We're getting a dozen listeners per episode. Maybe.
Clearly.
Maybe. So, you know, growing, right? Like, when we first started this, no listeners. Like, we wouldn't even listen to ourselves.
Well, you would because you're weird. But I'm a normal person, and I don't. Because I live it.
You do live it. You do. So, yeah, the Charlie Brown Thanksgiving special. There was actually two of them. One of them's from early 70s, 1971, I think, maybe 73. And then in 1985, they made another one that was about the Mayflower Voyagers. So I intend to sort of talk a little bit about both. I think that in your preparations for this particular show, you only watched the first one, which was the one where Charlie Brown and his friends sort of invite themselves over to his house for Thanksgiving, and he has a hard time saying no, and they're pretty insistent, and he doesn't really know how to make anything other than, like, toast and popcorn. And so
first of all, I just want to highlight the fact that I did do preparations for this episode, which is more than I normally do. So, yeah, I'm ready to go. I watched exactly what you're saying. Go ahead.
Well, then you take over from there, because people prefer listening to you.
Really?
97% of scientists agree. They prefer Robert telling us how the movies go.
Okay, well, you can correct me, because I was mostly watching it. But, I mean, come on, it's Charlie Brown. There's, like, hardly anything going on. So, it's Thanksgiving, and for some reason all the adults are gone, because Charlie Brown, there's never any adults around, unless they're needed for the plot, because they magically appear at the very end.
Well, they always say, wah, 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 wah.
Well, they're always off-screen, yeah. And then but at the very end, all of a sudden, they're driving the car to Grandma's house. But anyway, so, yeah, his friends call him up, or at least Peppermint Patty does, and she kind of invites herself over for Thanksgiving. And Charlie Brown doesn't know what to do, because he's alone, and all he can do is cook toast and popcorn. And he doesn't even actually end up cooking it. Freaking Snoopy does. But anyway, so the friends invite themselves over, and he's, like, doing all this pre-preparations. And Snoopy's doing every single thing. I don't even understand what Charlie Brown does in this movie. Snoopy does everything. Snoopy sets up the table in the backyard. He puts a sheet out. He wrestles with an animated living folding chair. This thing is, like, fighting him, and it's alive. So
the jazz music.
Yeah. No, so they stretch it out. I mean, the script was, like, you know, 3 pages long, so they had to pad. So Snoopy does everything. Snoopy cooks all the food, even though Charlie Brown said, well, I only know how to cook toast and popcorn. Meanwhile, his dog does it all. No one seems to even bat an eyeball at that. So who should really be offended when Peppermint Patty complains about the food is Snoopy, but Charlie Brown instead gets offended. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. So Snoopy, and most of the movie is just Snoopy preparing everything. So Snoopy goes out and he sets up the tables and chairs in the backyard. Then they spend a montage of Snoopy cooking all the food. Then the friends come over and he sits them down all in the backyard. And then Snoopy even serves all the food. I don't even know what Charlie Brown does. Charlie Brown doesn't do a damn thing. But then Peppermint Patty, who has invited herself and all the friends over, complains that, what the hell is this? This is just, what is this food? This is just toast and popcorn. What are you doing to me, Chuck? You're killing me. And then Chuck gets all upset. Like, rightfully so. He's like, are you kidding me? You invited yourself over. This is what we have. I don't have any friends, you know, adults around to cook, like, turkeys and stuff. This is all I know how to cook. Meanwhile, okay, go ahead. Never mind. Okay, I'm getting ahead of myself. So screw you. But instead, he doesn't say that. He just gets upset, and he goes inside in the house. Then who's, like, Peppermint Patty's, like, person that always calls her sir, like, her friend? You know who that is?
Marcy.
You know the name of that person? Marcy. So Marcy's like, hey, weren't you being a little bit hard on Charlie Brown there? Well, you should go apologize. And Peppermint Patty's like, well, why don't you go do it for me? Because, you know, I don't do anything for myself. Charlie Brown doesn't do anything for himself, so why should I do anything for myself? Anyway, so she does. She goes out and she's like, hey, Peppermint Patty, she's sometimes hard on you, but sorry about that. And then I guess, like, Peppermint Patty comes in there, and then she apologizes. And then, like, he gets a call, or he makes a call to his grandma. And then they just all go over. They get invited over to his grandma's house. And then a car appears that's driven by adults, we assume. But the kids are sitting in the back seat. And that's the end of the movie, as they go to the grandma's house. And then it cuts to Snoopy, who pulls out this fully cooked Thanksgiving turkey that he obviously cooked himself. And he eats it together with Woodstock as the credits roll. And that's your movie. So, recap, Charlie Brown doesn't do a damn thing. Snoopy does everything. When Peppermint Patty complains about the food, Snoopy should be the one that gets upset. But instead, Charlie Brown does, for reasons. Yeah, that's about it. What do you got on this movie, Daniel? I know you actually, I was struggling to find a reason to talk about this movie from a, like, libertarian, you know, anarchist, NAP standpoint, and then you kind of brought up the idea that Peppermint Penny kind of invites herself over, but I want to hear what you had to say, because I was struggling. I couldn't really see much of anything to talk about for this movie, I mean, other than just the ridiculousness of the plot and just how the dog did everything. Charlie Brown did absolutely nothing when they were his friends, but apparently, yeah, anyway, Snoopy, whatever. Is that a common theme? Does Snoopy all do all the work? I don't know.
Well, you did say that once you've seen one, you've seen them all, so you tell me.
I just remember them being like nothing movies, just where nothing really much happens. In the 3D animated movie, Snoopy, he has a series of like World War I things, which is a thing.
The Red Baron thing? Yeah.
Yeah, he's like the Red Baron, and there's like a romance. There's like this pink poodle, I want to say, that he like falls in love with, and that kind of runs throughout the movie. Because you got to pad in a Charlie Brown movie, you have to pad because the plot is super nothing. The entire plot of the Charlie Brown Peanuts movie is that there's a new girl in school, and Charlie Brown likes her, and Charlie Brown is nervous to talk to her. And he makes a fool of himself dancing, and she likes it. And there's a series of events where he kind of makes a fool of himself. And then at the very, very end, spoiler alert, he talks to her, and she likes him. And there's your movie.
Wait, is that the redheaded girl?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I remember the redheaded girl.
So you've seen the movie, or is that a thing from previous Charlie Brown movies?
It's a thing.
It's just a replay of every Charlie Brown movie ever then.
Yeah, and it's surprising watching this now as I'm, you know, almost 40. You see a lot of the adult humor in it. Like, there's situations where kids won't get it, but adults will, and it's kind of a wink and a nod. And there's a lot of pairing up or yearning for relationships with in between the characters. Like, Peppermint Patty has a thing for Chuck, and she's always hating on him. Lucy really likes Schroeder. Someone really likes Linus. Like, there's a lot of this unrequited love, like, overtures between the different groups, you know. Like, Patty likes Chuck, but then Chuck likes the redheaded girl.
Right, they're like, what, like 6 or 7?
Yeah, but there's all these love triangles going on. It's crazy.
Yeah, and I don't remember ever, like, I didn't get into women until later, but whatever.
Yeah, you'll get there. Don't worry, you'll get there.
I hope so.
So, your recap was pretty good. I mean, that's pretty much the story. There's not a whole lot to it, at least to this first Thanksgiving special. I do want to just mention a couple of things. So, first thing, Peppermint Patty, just remember this for your trivia night memory banks. Her actual name is Priscilla, not Patricia. So if it's ever a trivia question, Peppermint Patty, what's her real name? Priscilla.
Priscilla Patty?
Yeah, Priscilla. I don't know. Is Patty her last name?
There's no way to know. We can never
There's no
find
way
out.
To know. But her real name is Priscilla, so that's going to score you some points. And if you do win anything on Trivia Night, do use some of those proceeds to click on one of our Amazon links and buy anything of your choosing. And we'd appreciate that. So, the rest of what you described, yeah, is pretty much Peppermint Patty just invites herself over, and that's a little bit of a minor violation of the NAP. Like, it's his house, it's his property. He doesn't necessarily want people to go there, but he's too. He's not forceful enough to say no, so they end up coming over. And there is, even in the early 70s, there's that diversity thing that we were talking about in the last episode, because they bring a character named Franklin, who's a black kid, and he's not one of the main characters as far as I'm aware, but he's like you were saying in the last episode, South Park's token. Like, he doesn't even say anything, I don't think, in the whole episode. He's just there to be there, and they make sure to, like, mention him a couple of times in the episode.
Good. Make sure they're not racist by being racist. It's good.
Yeah.
So were there any – okay, so you're saying that her inviting herself over is sort of a violation of the NAP. Now, you might need to explain or provide an argument for that, because I would say that it's more on Charlie Brown to say, no, I don't want you over. Because someone can knock on your door, and that's not necessarily an act of aggression. Someone can come to your house unannounced and just knock on your door. It's on you to say, I'm sorry, you're not welcome here right now. If I go and knock on someone's door, you can't be saying that that's an act of aggression, are you?
No, but the person who owns the house certainly sets the rules, right? And so if you have, say, a gate in front of your house or a big fence, you know, and it's clear that it's not like a open yourself gate, then, you know, no one should be coming knocking on your door. Or if someone has familiarity with you and knows that, you know, you're not keen to have people show up at your house, that they need to call ahead and make arrangements, then, I think there's spoken and unspoken expectations that are set forth by the property owner. And Peppermint Patty, Priscilla, was certainly inviting herself over. And you're right, Charlie Brown wasn't really saying no very forcefully. He was sort of hemming and hawing about it. But I think that he should have been able to set the terms of the visit because it was his house. Like Tom Wood says in his Liberty Classroom, if you have a rule that says people who come over to your house need to wear funny hats, then that's the rule. Like, it's your house. They don't wear the funny hat, they got to go.
Okay, well, what do you think about this? In the history of Peanuts, Peppermint Patty and Charlie Brown are known to each other. They have an established relationship. They're friends going back, you know, since the 50s or whenever it was invented. And that is the dynamic of their relationship. Peppermint Patty is the initiator. She will talk to Chuck. She initiates the discussions. She kind of, I don't know, like bowls over his kind of go-along, get-along nature. She kind of forces herself on him. So it's kind of like an established known dynamic. And he's never really done anything to stop that. He's just always gone along with whatever. So at some point, it's on him to say no. From her point of view, she's been getting nothing but compliance for decades, these six-year-old kids. So I find it hard to say that this is any kind of aggression at this point.
Wow, a lot to unpack there, Johnson.
Okay. Well, I guess we're going to actually have something to talk about in this episode. Good.
Well, I mean, your argument is basically saying, well, you know, a slave's been a slave his whole life, and he doesn't know any different, so therefore it's okay for him to be a slave, even if no aggression needs to be brought upon him specifically.
Are you calling Charlie Brown a slave?
No, I'm just expanding your argument to a reductio. But you're saying just because somebody's used to a certain type of behavior, then all of a sudden it's okay. And
if you come to expect a certain dynamic in a relationship, it's not on the person. Well, are you saying that it's Peppermint Patty that should all of a sudden change her behavior because she's just going to all of a sudden realize that, oh, hey, Chuck doesn't like what I'm doing, even though he's never told me, he's never, ever said anything to stop me from acting this way?
Without knowing what has happened on previous holidays, I would think that there is a difference between inviting yourself over, being in the neighborhood, and stopping by on a random Tuesday versus a holiday that's traditionally a family holiday.
Okay, is it enough to violate the NAP?
Probably not in this situation because there's no violence. So it's a bit of a stretch, but...
Well, Snoopy does wrestle with a chair.
Well, and he also does... fling Woodstock out of Woodstock's nest across the ground, and Woodstock crashes into the floor. And
yeah, Snoopy's a total jerk to Woodstock.
Yeah.
What's that? What's up that?
And then they just start
like buddies. It's like a totally abusive relationship.
Yeah, and then they just start listening to jazz music and playing basketball. Yeah, whatever.
Oh, but, you know, domestic violence is hilarious.
Yeah, well, it's cartoons. Animated violence is okay.
Yeah.
So I suppose I'm a little bit more sensitive to the whole uninvited guest thing because it happened to me recently where my mom, who lives almost 2 hours away, an hour and a half away, showed up at our house on a random Tuesday.
Did you have a history of doing this?
No. No, and we always have to prearrange, you know, like, oh, let's meet up, you know, in a couple of weeks. Let's plan to get together for this or that. And okay. She had texted me, like, the Sunday before, and I hadn't responded yet, and her text was, hey, I'm going to have some time off in the next 2 weeks, so let's try to get together in the next 2 weeks. And 2 days later, she shows up at our house, and we were gone, actually, the day before that, and we were going somewhere the day after, so it just was, you know, luck that we were actually home, but she showed up right in the middle.
Or she tried the day before, and was like, oh, they're gone, I'll come back tomorrow.
Yeah, maybe, right? So she shows up, and, you know, I'm working, and the kids are about ready to go down for a nap, and all of a sudden there's guests, you know? And it's not like an in-the-neighborhood thing. And I don't know if this is like a generational thing. Like 20 years ago, maybe it was fine to just show up at someone's house. you know, because technology wasn't as good. You know, you had to like call from your house to someone else's house and hope that they caught the phone in time. But now, you know, everyone's got cell phones and you can text and you can make arrangements. So it just seemed to me to be a rather rude thing for them to just show up.
With your situation you're describing, it does seem to be more of a imposing an imposition on your time than, say, a stop and pop, you know, a neighborhood pop in from like your friend across the street to just pop in and say, hey, what's up?
Right. Like when you were still living nearby, whenever we were down that way, we would sometimes pop by and, you know, around. But that seems like a different thing than a purposeful, like, hey, we're going to travel for an hour and a half to show up at your house specifically, whether you're there or not, and just invite ourselves in. So,
right.
Perhaps I'm internalizing the situation with this Peanuts Thanksgiving special.
So you're equating Peppermint Patty to your mom. And you're projecting your experience on this cartoon character.
You know, maybe it's her complaininess, you know, because my mom is known to complain a bit. So when Peppermint Patty's like, what blockhead cooked all this? What kind of Thanksgiving dinner is this? There's no turkey, just toast?
Daniel's having flashbacks when he's watching this movie.
We're getting personal now. Oh, yeah. Anyway, so the other thing I wanted to mention about this, and this ties into the second episode of their Thanksgiving special, is they throw a lot of history into the show, which is kind of cool. Like even in this first one, Linus is telling them all about the first Thanksgiving, and you know the Indian chief Massasoit was there in 1621, and he brought his tribes people to join and break bread with the settlers, and like that's pretty advanced stuff to put in a cartoon intended for like 6-year-olds or 10-year-olds, you know?
Yeah, that kind of caught me off guard a little bit because I'm not used to, I guess from today's kind of kids' entertainment, getting just like history thrown at me like that. That probably seems to be more of a thing they did back then. But yeah, you don't
like
normally see like, I don't know, the Power Rangers all of a sudden start talking about Ben Franklin or something. It'd just be weird.
Yeah, and they were talking about like they came to this new world to, you know, free themselves from religious persecution. They wanted freedom and justice. You know, all this stuff. It was kind of cool to see that, like them throw in a lot of information into a cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, when they get in the car, you know, it's one of those station wagons where the seats go every which way. You know, the ones where they have the pop-up seat in the back where you can actually sit in the back and look out the back window.
Right, so all the kids aren't buckled up.
Yeah, there's no seatbelts.
Yeah.
They're just, you know, rumbling along, no seatbelts, just talking about how they're going to grandma's house, and they're singing the song, like, through the wood to grandmother's house we go. And then, of course, Charlie Brown at the end says, the only problem is my grandma doesn't live in a house. She lives in a condominium.
But and then, yeah, then the show's over.
Yeah, then the show's over.
And then they cut to Snoopy cooking a giant turkey or having a giant turkey just ready to go, and then him and Woodstock eat it.
Right, because all the complaints about the other food he had prepped, you know, when they could have had that turkey, they would not have had those complaints. Oh, and you mentioned the Marcy and Peppermint Patty thing where she and Chuck were getting into it a little bit. So Peppermint Patty sends Marcy in as her designated dispute resolution officer to go and settle things up with Charlie Brown. So just wanted to bring
Steph Molyneux. I don't know if that's a bit of a stretch because all she does is apologize for her.
Right. Well, really sometimes that's all that would be needed is an apology, right? Like how many times does a court case come about that says, you know, I just want an apology, a public apology.
Sure. But it's also a bit of Peppermint Patty just not owning up to what she did. Right.
Yeah. She should own the transgression. Be it as it was, you know, I mean, the whole point was she was complaining about the food, and then Marcy brings up the point, well, you did invite yourself over. Like, what do you expect? Like, you can't invite yourself over somewhere and then complain about the service.
Right.
So I'd agree with that. That's a good lesson.
I think it's a very good lesson. Absolutely. There's way too much entitlement where you're like, well, you have to provide the service to me because I'm here and you owe it to me or something like that.
Right.
Very Ann Conley.
Because healthcare is a right or education is a right or anything is a right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't understand. I mean, I always say I don't understand, but then we do understand. But we don't see how someone can make the argument and believe it that all these ANCOM things should be enacted. Like, things should be provided based on need and with no care for why it's created, any incentive for it to be created, any compensation for it being created. You know what I'm saying. And if anyone's listened to the previous 30 episodes of this podcast, you'll know what we're talking about.
This thing exists. Right. They just say, well, this thing exists, and there's enough for everybody to go around. Never mind why it's there or how it got created or why so many things of it do exist. It exists now, so we're going to just take it, and then we'll basically kill the golden goose, and there won't be any of it in the future. But who cares about the future? It's a very infantile, I want it now kind of attitude. I don't know. It's really weird.
Yeah, it's very short-sighted, because wherever that point is where they take over the means of production, that's it. That's the end, right? So whatever level, like you know those old strategy games we used to play where, like, you're in the Stone Age, and then you're in the Bronze Age, and then you're in the Iron Age. Like, whatever age you're in, as soon as it goes ANCOM, you're there. That's it. And then it's just going to start devolving back to previous ages.
Right, because the incentive to innovate is gone.
Yeah, so
and
whatever level...
You can probably get into it and explain all that why, but the whole incentive to innovate and create and to be rewarded for your efforts evaporates in an ANCOM society.
Yeah, so that just, like we said, doesn't make any sense. But let's move on to
the nature.
Yeah, well, that's why they wanted to have a new socialist man, because apparently normal man wouldn't cut it in socialist land, socialist utopia.
But it goes against DNA. You're going against the fundamental nature of life. I mean, good luck. Whereas ANCOM, or ANCAPs, utilize human greed for the betterment of all. It's like judo, man. It's good. Anyway, let's move on to this next thing that I have not seen.
All right, so this next one is basically the Peanuts characters go back and recreate the Mayflower Voyage from Plymouth to the New World. And this is, you know, 1620-ish. They go into the whole history. They throw in the dates and the whole all the different characters and a lot of the events that happen. And it's actually kind of crazy, because they talk about how horrific the journey was and how people were getting seasick, and they actually show them, like, throwing up over the side of the boat. We talk about all the illnesses and the number of people that died. I mean, this is a kid's show. You know, like, oh, yeah, 101 people left on the voyage, but, you know, three people died and two children were born, so 100 people actually made it. But then once they're there, you know, it's pretty much wilderness. You know, there's Indian people around or evidence of it, but they don't see them for many months. And so they're, you know, struggling to survive even once they've reached land. And they talk about, you know...
Well, a time of year when they couldn't exactly, like, grow, or is that something like that? I don't even know.
Yeah, it says that they land about early November in 1620 into New England, so you'd imagine that would start to be getting pretty cold.
Right, yeah, you couldn't exactly grow crops.
Yeah,
but
in that first, you know, 6 months or whatever after they had landed, they talk about how half of the adults died.
Hmm.
And all the kids survived, apparently, but... It's kind of crazy that, you know, they talk about that level of detail with a kid show, a children's show. But anyway, I digress. So they're talking about how they're setting up the voyage from Plymouth in England, and there's, like, a bunch of kids on there, and there's these pilgrims, and there's the crew, and there's merchants seeking wealth in the new land. So, and they sort of portray them as, like, shifty characters are sitting around playing, like, cards and looking, like, surly. So it's like they're sort of painting them in a negative light compared to the pious pilgrims. And talk about how there's a contract with the English merchants, and the merchants and the pilgrims will share any profits of the New World, so they're financing the journey. And it talks about how they're going to arrive in a virtual wilderness, because there's hardly any, like, the whole North American continent back in, you know, the 1400s, 1600s, there were only something like 5 or 10 million people in the whole area. So it was fairly sparsely populated, especially compared to today.
Right.
And they talk about how they were desiring to seek freedom from religious persecution. There's terrible conditions aboard the ship. Everyone's getting violently ill. They have to sleep in these, like, on straw on the floor, and you go through all these storms, and it's a harrowing journey. And they make the Mayflower Compact, which is supposed to be the rules for the new world, for the new society. So it's like the first institution of government in this area.
Okay, and what did they get into that, what those were?
No, they don't get into too many specifics, but I do recall hearing about it when I was in school way back in the day. I don't recall what the compact was about, but they mention it in this show as it's the charter and the rules for their society in the wilderness.
Okay, but that would actually almost be a legitimate contract if all aboard had agreed to this thing. But
yeah, if it was unanimous, sure.
Right. Or if their agreement was contingent, you know, going on the trip was contingent upon them agreeing to this thing. Did they say that this was an agreement that was made, this Mayflower Compact was made before they left or after they got there? Because after they got there, it would be a bit of a, I'm not so happy with that. But
yeah, it's when they got there.
Yeah.
But then they also, you know, they don't run into any natives, but they do notice that the land looks like it's been cleared, so perhaps it appears to be homesteaded, so that might be an interesting thing to talk about. And then they start building structures, so they're homesteading the area that appears to be abandoned.
Okay, so these are, they're building on land that already appeared to be homesteaded, like of tribes that would move around?
Yeah, like the area had been cleared, so there weren't a bunch of trees. So there were open areas that would have been suitable for growing crops, but no one was around. And so it sounds, looks like what they're saying, well, no one's around, so we're going to just start building our own stuff here.
Okay. Now, and nobody came and said, hey, this is not your land? Because, right, the natives didn't necessarily think of it that way?
Yeah, I think there's a fair amount of that where Indians didn't believe in the concept of ownership of property. I don't know if that's all tribes or some tribes, and it's very loosely in my head, like even where I've heard that from. So I don't know how legitimate that is or not. But in the show, it's explained that one of the tribes that did clear the land, they were all they all died from a disease, and only one survivor was left. And that's Squanto, and he's the one who takes pity on the pilgrims and helps them to learn how to raise corn and catch fish and settle into the land, which then results in their first harvest together, so the first Thanksgiving. And then one of the neighboring tribes with Massasoit, who Massachusetts named after, his tribe joins them for the celebration.
Okay.
So, you know, Thanksgiving-ness, a little bit about the actual history of it in a cartoon form, which is kind of cool. He says, I've got a couple of clips of it here. It says, my people welcome you to our land. This is the land of the Patuxet tribe, but they're all dead, a terrible plague. I'm the only survivor. And they say, the pilgrims say, well, if you know, we might need to return to England unless we get help to be able to be here. And Squanto says to them that he had been kidnapped from there and had been brought to Europe and made it back, and so he wants to stay there, so he'll help them stay there because it's the land is the home of his people.
So Squanto had been to London before, or England?
Yeah, he had been kidnapped and taken to Spain, and then he escaped to London, and he learned English, and then he made it back to the New World.
Okay, so the Pilgrims were just the first, like, permanent colony, more or less? I mean, there was, like, what, Jamestown? I don't know my dates, but...
Yeah, I think Jamestown was before that, and that disappeared without a trace. Like, everyone just disappeared. But, yeah, Plymouth was 1620, and Plymouth Rock's a big deal in American history. And again, you know, Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom. Check out the U.S. history section about the first Pilgrims.
There you go.
I haven't done that yet. I think I will need to. ReadRothbard.com/Liberty Classroom. Black Friday special. Save up to 40% off Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom. And I clearly need to check that out myself in regards to this particular event, which is the Pilgrims Landing at Plymouth Rock.
Okay, so with everybody being dead, but the land being cleared and just Squanto's there, sure seems to me that the colonists there aren't aggressing against anybody. I mean, Squanto seems to be okay with it, even though
he's the last surviving heir, right?
Yeah.
And he says that, yeah, you know, I want to stay here, and so I'll help you guys. So, yeah, he invites them to be there.
So I don't see an issue there. Are there any kind of NAP issues that we could talk about in regards to this story? I know there have been some ANCOM kind of complaints about homesteading, that just because you mix your labor with a place doesn't mean you have any particular or special or greater right to be in a place than anybody else. But it sure seems to me that if you clear the land, chop down some trees, put those trees in the shape of a house, you seem to have a better claim to that land and that space than somebody who's just walking by.
Yeah, I mean, is their argument that it's unowned and unclaimed land, like it's raw wilderness type land, like no one has done anything to it at all, and yet they'll still say that we collectively all own it?
I think their argument is that there's no such thing as private property, right? So that no matter what the state of land is, everybody owns it.
But you can have personal effects, and wherever that line is drawn is very murky.
Yeah, the definition of personal property, like your toothbrush and stuff, but I mean, they don't really get into details, of course. It's all very murky and mysterious. And what happens when two ANCOMs disagree over what is personal property and what's means of production? I don't know what happens there. And it is a concept, right? The idea that you own a thing, but it sure seems to be that, how could you say that you have an equal claim to, I don't know, a toaster as the guy that built the toaster? It just, how do you make that argument? That you're somehow aggressing against somebody by not letting you use their toaster. Because that's the argument. They say that you are actually aggressing against somebody by not allowing them to use a thing.
But they're talking about land more specifically, right?
No, they talk about anything, any means of production that they call means of production, or land. Like if you have two houses and you don't let me live in that house that you're not currently in, you are aggressing against me by denying me use of that house. Or if you have two sandwiches and you're not eating one of them, you're aggressing against me by not giving me that sandwich. Just because you happen to currently have a thing. It's a very short-sighted, very now argument, and it always seems to be, well, we don't even recognize how that thing got to be, or how you happened to get that sandwich, and how all the effort and labor you went into making it, or whatever. It's just you happen to have it right now.
Yeah, we've played that clip of Murray talking about how much work and how many years it takes for even just a ham sandwich to be made.
Right.
It's a ridiculous amount of interconnected things in the free market that go back decades. Yeah, it does seem to be very much this thing is just magically here, and because it's now here, it must be distributed equally among us.
Right, with no reference or no appreciation of how it got there or who made it or whatever. It's a very, I don't know. People talk about entitlements. It seems like it's a very entitled philosophy where this thing exists and you're not currently using it. Therefore, you're attacking me by not letting me use it.
But withholding it from me, and therefore I am a victim.
You are an oppressed victim class, absolutely.
Okay, so this ties right into the SJW stuff we were talking about before. It's that whole victim mentality.
These lefties, man, their communist philosophy flows through their veins.
Yeah, you know, in our previous episode, I wanted to mention this. It does seem to be that it is a cultural wave that is the first to take root, and then it becomes an intellectual wave. Like, you see these types of things getting presented over the course of time in movies and television. Like the gay marriage and the transgender stuff, like we started seeing that in TV shows and movies in the 80s and 90s, and then it became more recently like a political movement. And it does seem to be that that's a fast track to getting something moving along, is to first enculturate it or bring it into the culture first and then start pushing it progressively in the political sphere.
That's interesting. That might be the way it goes. I definitely think that that's the way I'm doing it, by creating a thing that espouses certain ideas. So I'm putting it out into the culture, I guess you could say, by writing a book about it. Or we are doing a thing right now by talking about it and putting it out there in a podcast form. So we're putting our ideas out there into the culture. And then hopefully those ideas get adopted and become more normalized and mainstream.
Yeah, though, you know, promulgating our ideas politically means being apolitical. It just means stop being aggressive. Stop making people do things that they don't want to do under the threat of force. That's our whole shtick. I mean, you talk about Peanuts having the same script for every show, every episode, every special. Same thing here, buddy.
Yeah, have you, I know you don't really watch Steph anymore, and I don't either, but I downloaded an episode of his show, Free Domain Radio, where he's talking about, it was right after Trump's victory, and they're basically patting themselves on the back the whole episode and patting other kind of like alt-right people like Breitbart and other people like that and just congratulating themselves on Trump's victory and whatever. And there's a couple times in the episode where Steph is going, and I want to thank all my principled libertarian or principled friends who thought that I was kind of straying from being principled and talking about how political action was bad and why I changed. And hopefully you'll now see the light and you'll understand. And if you don't understand now, you soon will, by how amazing Donald Trump is going to be. And I found it to be very condescending. Like, oh, I just don't understand, Steph. I just don't understand this genius move you've made to get Donald Trump elected. I think he'll be a little bit disappointed when Trump turns out to be another politician. But, you know, maybe he's right, and maybe Trump's going to be this amazing libertarian anarchist-type president. I don't think so with what he said about trade and how he's not for free trade. He's just for better trade deals or whatever. But there's a whole all kinds of authoritarian things he said, and talking about bigger military and better military and whatever. But the whole condescending thing that he's saying, like, we just don't get it, what he's doing, it's kind of disappointing. But it kind of reaffirms my acknowledgement that he has moved away from a principled argumentation stance. I hope he holds all the horrible things that Trump's going to do, hold him to task on that, instead of just being this Trump cheerleader as of late. We'll see.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting thing to – I mean, he's one of those guys who knows the arguments backwards and forwards, like you were saying in our previous episode about minarchists and how they – even if they know the arguments about anarchism – and yet they still refuse to see them. I mean, this is even worse. This is a guy who was a full-blown anarchist. Like, he was anarchist before you and I even knew what that meant. Like, he pushed us in many of those ways.
Right.
Like, his Everyday Anarchy and Practical Anarchy, which are actually really good books, like, really solidified a lot of our thinking. And then he turns around on that for this Trump phenomenon.
Full-on minarchist, yeah. Full-on minarchist for Trump. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if he's going to go ahead and do that for, you know, monetary reasons, to grow his audience, to get, you know, alt-righters on board or whatever, that's one thing, I suppose. But he is absolutely, in my view, he's betraying his principal past. And just the whole condescending nature of, well, you just don't understand. Maybe you'll understand now soon, now that Trump's going to be in office. I'm going to be shocked if Trump is like this amazing freedom guy. Good luck. Never in the history of anything has anybody been elected to this crazy power and it's not corrupted them and made them have done horrible things. Like, there was an article, it was in Newsweek, and it seemed to be a very backpedaling article for Newsweek. I mean, they're the ones that did the whole Hillary, her reign begins thing before she actually won, which she didn't. And it was all about why Hillary lost and what Trump is now going to do. And the article actually said that Trump is going to destroy and dismantle all the presidential orders that Obama did. And I was like, good luck with that. You really think he's going to look at all this power and go, nah, let's get rid of it. Nah, this is wrong. It's wrong. It's not going to happen. I'd be shocked if he gets rid of anyone. He might not use all of them, but chances are he's going to – anyway, the idea that he's going to dismantle them is ridiculous. But – you can live in that fantasy world, I suppose.
Yeah, I wonder if Steph's more referring to the backlash to the SJWs. Like, I had blamed the whole thing on SJWs, like Zarna and the rest of them, for pushing the narrative so far that even just normal people who are, not racist in any way are being accused of it, and that the only voice of sanity or the only way of repelling that was to vote against Hillary.
Right. Yeah, I definitely think that was part of it. That was definitely part. I think that was definitely part of it, where people were just fed up being called a racist. But honestly, mostly people seem to vote along party lines. I mean, they didn't get a whole lot. Trump did get some swing states and did get some traditionally blue states. So there's definitely something to be said about that. But like we talked about in the previous episodes, only 30% of the country voted. Anyway, there. Yeah.
Our guy didn't win.
Yeah.
No one.
Our guy
no
always,
didn't win.
Always, our guy. Nobody already always loses. There's always some douchebag sitting in the chair.
But
it's funny, though. There was an article I saw today, and I'm not going to reference it because I just scan these things. But it was saying how a lot of the people that have been arrested in Portland for rioting didn't vote, which I think is kind of funny.
Yeah, I saw that, too. Like, half of them said they didn't even vote.
Yeah. So you're all upset about the election results, but you didn't partake.
But I'll bet 97% of them responded to the Craigslist ad saying, "Want to stop Donald Trump? $15 an hour. Head to downtown Portland."
Right.
I saw a bunch of those ads posted, like screenshots of those.
Nice.
But yeah, the thing with Trump is he was throughout the whole election cycle, he was the anti-PC, anti-SJW guy. Just didn't have any time for it. Just said, "Oh, this is all bullshit." And I think that was something that a lot of people agree with.
Yeah, that resonated for sure. Even if I hate the guy and he's a politician, that would absolutely resonate with me because I agree with that for sure.
Yeah. So if you didn't have
if
you didn't have any principles as far as like voting is violence and the NAP, then you might, if you were still within that political realm, would have been drawn towards that, right?
Sure. Oh, especially more than a corrupt criminal, career criminal like Hillary. At least Donald's crimes are all in the future, most of them, where Hillary's are well established in the past and currently. So at least you could say get the criminals out, which is, I know, the mantra of many people who reluctantly partake in the system.
Yeah, vote the bums out.
Yeah.
Put new bums in.
Right. Yeah.
Doesn't really...
Let somebody else try. Yeah, it's a system that is broken and inherently broken. And you're not going to fix it by getting the right people in. I mean, maybe with a guy like Ron Paul, who's just going to say no, no, no. But he's the exception that proves the rule. You can't join the mafia and turn it into the Boy Scouts.
Yeah, old boss is the same as the new boss. Or new boss same as old boss, however the saying goes.
That's how it goes.
Yeah. Oh, that reminds me. Larkin Rose did that special the other day or a few weeks back where he was offering a couple of his books and one of them on audio for like $20. So I ordered that up.
And you got to the top of the list.
Yeah, now I'm on some like no-fly list or some other list I wasn't already on. Yeah. And I did listen to the audio version of The Iron Web that Larkin reads, and he's actually his audio is actually pretty half decent.
Nice.
So I listened to the whole thing, and it's a really exciting and interesting book. He couches a lot of his arguments into the narrative of the book, and that gets a little bit preachy, but you just kind of roll with it. But I don't know if you're very familiar with the story at all. But spoiler alert, one of his main characters is president-elect, similar to Donald Trump right now. And on the inauguration day, he goes up there and says, "Hey, everyone, I've been a senator for X number of years, and I ran this election cycle, and I lied to you. I'm not going to do anything that I said I was going to do. I'm going to fire all the agencies right now. Everyone who works for any agency in the federal government is now fired. I'm shutting down all these departments." he gives like the big John Galt speech, but during the presidential inauguration. It's like super awesome. And I posted in the Tom Woods group the other day, like, anyone want to take the odds on whether Trump is going to do the Grant Collins speech from The Iron Web in January? And there was like not even 1,000,000 to 1.
Yeah, not even. I wouldn't even put a penny on it. Not even a penny. Just throwing money away. I don't care what odds you give me.
But it would be cool. But you should check it out there, Johnson, Iron Web. It's a good book.
Cool. Cool. Sounds very cool. So it's a kind of a thriller?
Yeah, a little bit. There's a little bit of the insurgent action and a situation that gets blown way out of proportion. Starts out very, very small and becomes escalated very quickly due to law enforcement. Well, I mean, that's one of Larkin's arguments, is that law enforcement is trained to escalate situations.
They are trained to escalate because they have to be in control at all times. And if anybody ever challenges them, they will physically attack you.
Yeah. So I think that you would enjoy the book. Your blood might boil a little bit just in some of the situations as they get developed. But yeah, I've got
in a good
hard
way.
He has to describe
frustratingly enough that it doesn't get resolved.
Well, some of it doesn't. I mean, some people do end up dying as a result. But he has to tell us a story, right? He has to tell a situation. He has to set it up.
Sure.
You have to have conflict and resolution.
Yeah, that's how stories work.
Yeah, Mr. Author. So anyway, I've got a hard copy of the book, which the next time I see you, if I do, I will make sure it's available for you.
Cool. I do better with audiobooks, but I like hard copies too.
We'll find a way.
Sure, there's probably a way.
Yeah. So anything else you want to talk about Thanksgiving in general? We can start winding down our Thanksgiving special here.
Yeah, I know that we could probably get into like cultural appropriation and people dressing up. I saw a really dumb BuzzFeed video recently. Well, somebody trashing a BuzzFeed video recently where they were complaining about Halloween and Halloween costumes and how insensitive and inappropriate it is. And it's really dumb, really stupid. We've talked about that before. I've talked about cultural appropriation before and how really dumb it is. I don't know if you want to get into that, but there is a tendency to, it's Thanksgiving. It involves Native Americans, so we could hit that angle. But I don't know. I feel like we've done that. So I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like we talked about that incident with Hillary Duff. Like, she was a pilgrim and her boyfriend was an Indian, and she had to apologize because of it, which seems ridiculous. Because, I mean, who has been actually, like, demonstrably injured by somebody doing something called cultural appropriation? I mean, unless you're appropriating, like, a sacrifice ritual of some other culture where you're actually harming someone, killing someone, then there's a victim. But the victim is not the tribe or the culture that you're taking that from. It's the person you're killing.
Right. Yeah, that's why there's no such thing as a cultural appropriation, like lawsuit. There's no case. There's no, because in a lawsuit, in a case, you have to show, there has to be a plaintiff. There has to be somebody who was harmed. It's just people whining on the internet. It's weird, but that's what the internet's for, I suppose. So I guess that's where you're going to see stupid, dumb ideas. And there's like no filter for dumb ideas anymore, right? So they're just out there. So you get to see them all. It's kind of fun.
The internet for dumb ideas and porn. And for Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom, readrothbard.com/libertyclassroom. Check it out. Friday, Black Friday special, all weekend long. Save some coin. Save some smackers on Tom Wood's premier product of libertarian thought and philosophy, Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom.
.com.
/ all day long.
That's right. Doing it up.
All right, everyone. Well, hey, thank you so much for joining us for this Thanksgiving special. We do appreciate you. We are thankful to you, our faithful listener or listeners. I want to wish you a happy Thanksgiving, and we hope to have more episodes for you coming up. So thank you very much. Robert, you can sign us out, sir.
Yeah, enjoy your turkey day with your friends and your family. And if you do get involved in political discussion, as they are most assuredly going to happen, there's going to be a situation where Trump will get mentioned, and then probably most, at least in our neck of the woods, of the family are probably going to go, oh yeah, it's terrible, terrible. Maybe there's one of the two people that are silent who don't feel comfortable talking about any kind of the positives about it. But with the Tom Woods classroom, you would be better armed to get into those kind of discussions if they do escalate, at least before they're put the kibosh on by other members of the family. So thanks for listening. This has been the Read Rothbard Podcast with Daniel and Robert, and I hope everybody takes care. We'll be back next week.
Good night. All right, we were going to talk about Bill Burr real quick, so I'm going to plug this in to the Thanksgiving special.
This is nothing. This is so nothing. You'll see what this is, how nothing this is. But here you go, Daniel. So Bill Burr, he trashes both candidates constantly. I have many episodes for months and months. In fact, well, since the freaking election cycle was like, what, 9 months or 15 months or whatever it was. He's constantly trashing him. He was actually a Bernie supporter. So he was constantly trashing both Trump and Clinton, and I thought in equal measure. But he had more ammunition with Clinton because she's a career politician. She's a crook, and she's documented crook multiple times, many times over. So what else could he, you know, he had more ammunition for it. That's just the natural way of things. So anyway, it was kind of amusing because he did a bit on his podcast where he had a letter from a Trump supporter and a letter from a Hillary supporter. And the Trump supporter was calling him out for not supporting Trump. And the Hillary supporter was calling him out for supporting Trump and getting Trump elected. And it was just amusing that, you know, depending on your politics, you're going to see his content, you know, two different ways or three different ways or whatever. You just can't win with these people. He's so apolitical. And every time he talks about it, he goes, why am I talking about politics? I'm a moron. I don't pay attention. I don't know anything. But yet this Hillary letter was accusing him of getting Donald Trump elected or playing a part. And it was like, you know, you should look in the mirror and admit to yourself, you know, how can you live with yourself and, you know, that kind of thing where, you know, you, with all your power and your platform, you should have used it more responsibly, blah, 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 that sort of thing.
You white male, cis, non-gender specific, whatever.
Yeah, it was just funny because, you know, he's a comedian. He admits he doesn't know what he's talking about. He admits he's not very bright. In fact, if you ever listen to him, he can't even read out loud, and he admits that he can't read out loud. He says it all the time. It's a running joke that he can't read out loud, so he doesn't really know anything. And yet, you take stock in what he says about a candidate? I mean, I guess, but consider the source, like an adult would do. It's this childlike mentality that you're a slave to what a comedian says. Are you kidding me? Whatever. It was really dumb. It was amusing to hear it on his podcast. But these political supporters, to go and blame a comedian on a podcast that your candidate lost. Okay. You've gone to new heights. Take it to new heights. Good job. Way to double down on that. Good job. Put the blame on this guy. It's I found it amusing. And that's my Bill Burr story.
Well worth me hitting the record button once again, so thanks for that, and I'll throw this right into the end of the Thanksgiving special.
You do what you got to do, buddy.
All right, happy Thanksgiving to you, Robert, and happy Thanksgiving to all the listeners out there, and good night.
The chipmunks. C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do-do. Do-do-do-do. Do-do. Do-do-do-do.